Court is back in session.
Good morning, please be seated. Our final case for this morning is case number 57107, DeBoer versus Senior Bridges. Mr. Bradley for the appellants, Mr. Crawford for the respondents. Mr. Bradley.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court and counsel. I am Joe Bradley, counsel for Susan DeBoer in her capacity as legal guardian for Gail Savage. As the court understands, this case comes to this court on a Rule 12b-5 motion to dismiss in the district court. And the basis for that ruling was that Senior Bridges owed no duty to the appellant, Gail Savage, beyond providing non-negligent medical care. In reviewing a NRCP 12b-5 motion, it is, of course, reviewed de novo, and it is a very rigorous standard of review. The court must accept all of the plaintiff's facts as true, and they must draw all inferences from those facts in favor of the plaintiff. It's important to understand the facts of this case. Ms. Savage, in July of 2008, was found confused and wandering in a neighbor's backyard. The neighbor contacted the Reno Police Department, and Ms. Savage was transported to Senior Bridges, which is a subsidiary of the Sparks Family Hospital, Northern Nevada Medical Center. Once she was admitted there, she was, as is their routine, she was given an assessment by Dr. V. Fupulawata. And he did determine that Mrs. Savage was in fact suffering from mild to moderate dementia, and that she was incapable of making decisions regarding her personal and financial matters. Following that, on July 16th, she had been there 7 days. Senior Bridges is not an extended care facility for the treatment of dementia. They're essentially a clearinghouse. And throughout the 7 day period that Ms. Savage was remained at Senior Bridges, occasionally a friend of hers, Peggy Viola Six, would. And on July 16th, Larry Ling, a caseworker at Senior Bridges, spoke to Ms. Six and asked Ms. Six if she would undertake the care of Ms. Savage. Ms. Six replied that the only way that she would care for Ms. Savage is if Ms. Savage, the ward, would grant a general power of attorney in favor of Ms. Six over all of her personal and financial matters. A huge, huge undertaking, frankly. Despite Ms. Savage's mental incompetence and mental incapacity and her inability to understand the import of signing a general power of attorney, Larry Ling, social worker at Senior Bridges, retrieved, we believe, we've been able to do no discovery on this matter, but we believe that he retrieved a pre-printed form from the internet and presented it to Ms. Savage for her signature. Ms. Savage had been there 7 days. It's not a traditional hospital that you enter into and leave or discharge by a regular medical doctor. It's more custodial in nature. And of course, she was concerned about her pets. She didn't really understand the import of the general power of attorney, but essentially she wanted out of Senior Bridges. And she complied with the request and the condition that she sign the general power of attorney in favor of Ms. Six, and she was discharged from Senior Bridges on the 16th.
Are you asserting a general negligence claim in addition to a negligent undertaking claim? Is that how that's structured?
No, it's just a general negligence claim. I mean, this is simple duty, breach of duty, causation, proximate cause, and damages.
So you're not making a Wright versus Shum type claim that there was a negligent undertaking by Senior Bridges when Ling said, oh, I can help you out here. Here's a power of attorney. Let's go with it.
No, not at all. I mean, I think that at that time, Mr. Ling voluntarily assumed a special duty when he decided to meddle in Ms. Savage's affairs by requesting her or making a condition upon her discharge from that facility to require her to sign a general power of attorney, he assumed the duty that at that time to do so non-negligently. And I can't believe that requiring an incompetent person to sign a power of attorney, a general power of attorney, that when asking that individual to do that, knowing that she's mentally incompetent, it's right in the chart in front of you, they are in the business of elder care services, that you could
Mr.
request
Bradley,
that
I think that I think that argument is the source of Justice Pickering's question and mine too, is the argument that there exists a special relationship between the hospital and Ling your client, or alternatively, or in addition, is it that the providing of this these legal documents is a negligent undertaking?
No, it's the latter, the former, if you will.
So you maintain that there is the amended complaint in this case bases its negligence assertion against the defendant on the existence of a special relationship?
Yes. Yes, that's accurate. And also on general premises concepts of negligence, that they owed her a duty. You know, all human activity carries with it a duty to act reasonably and to act prudently and to act in a fashion that will not cause foreseeable harm. And that is the basis of duty. This court on many occasions has addressed the issue of duty. And duty in the Merluzzi versus Larson case is stated by this court to be a broad and dynamic concept, but that it is guided by the prime importance of foreseeability of harm. And when Mr. Ling undertook to do what he did, if he had done nothing, if he said, well, I'm not going to give you a general power of attorney, if he'd have done nothing and maybe had to hold her for a few more days or call the public guardian's office or call the elder protective services or speak to his supervisor about this woman has no heirs, has no family, how do we handle this? But undertaking to have her sign a general power of attorney as a condition to her discharge creates an obvious foreseeable risk.
So there's no difference between the general negligence and the negligent undertaking as far as you're concerned. In other words, when you allege general negligence, you're alleging negligence undertaking, according
yes.
to what you just said.
Exactly. I think they flow from one another. The relationship, of course, creates the special duty because she was in their custody, and by that relationship, they had a special duty to her when he undertook to do certain things, to do those things non-negligently. But even under general negligence concepts, he had a duty to act in a fashion that would preclude her from suffering foreseeable harm. Giving an incompetent person, having an incompetent person sign a power of attorney in favor of an unknown third person is fraught with problems.
And but you would not say, I mean, playing with the facts a bit, if he had not gotten into the issue of giving her a power of attorney and arranging, you know, facilitating that power of attorney and execution, if she had simply been released by Senior Bridges with that doctor's note in the file, but she's done there and she's released, and let's assume for this hypothetical that was medically appropriate, there would be no consequence attached to that release, in your theory, if 2 weeks later Mrs. Six had come and done the same thing exactly, only she was helped out by somebody else.
Let's assume.
Do you follow what I'm asking?
I do. Taking your facts, let's assume that he had released Ms. Savage to Ms. Six with no conditions.
Yes.
And that immediately Ms. Savage went home and had. Ms. Six took Ms. Savage home and printed off a general power of attorney and had her sign it, and then banks honored it, and so on and so forth. I doubt that we would be here today. It's the fact that that Ms. Savage was in the custodial care of Senior Bridges, and that Senior Bridges facilitated and abetted, essentially, Ms. Six's criminal conduct. And it was clearly foreseeable that that would happen because Ms. Savage did not have the requisite mental capacity to intervene and to stop everything that was going to happen. She did not have the capacity.
But wouldn't a classic special relationship claim then have cast upon Senior Bridges the duty to see to it that she was put in the hands of somebody to get her a guardianship?
I think that at that stage, when she is determined to be mentally incompetent, that perhaps they could release her to family members or to a known quantity, even essentially to Ms. Six. We haven't gotten the opportunity to do a great deal of discovery on what their policies and procedures are on admission and discharge.
Fair enough.
But certainly in this scenario, I think that it was incumbent upon them to ensure that she was put into a safe environment. And if I may
on the hypothetical,
the remainder of my time.
On the hypothetical we were discussing, would they have liability if Ling had handed Ms. Six a form as she walked out of the hospital with the patient?
I really don't think so. Because again, Ms. Savage does not have the mental capacity to enter into a general power of attorney. They could hand her discharge forms.
The reason for my hypothetical is I'm trying to focus on the duty owed by the hospital. Does the duty arise because they undertook to effectuate this relationship, and if the discovery shows that, for example, your understanding of the facts are different, all Ling did was give her a form with no advice, then there'd be no liability?
No, I don't agree with that. If he had provided her with a form, this was a conditional. From what we
understood, I understood your claim to be that if Ling took to provide the form, allowing Ms. Six the opportunity to secure power of attorney over her assets. This duty that we're talking about arrives because Ling is an employee of this hospital and is effectively dealing with an incompetent patient.
He facilitated the criminal activity by doing exactly what he did, and I think that had he provided Ms. Six a form to do the same thing, that his conduct would be, again, below the standard of care of a reasonably prudent caseworker in an elder care facility.
What do you say about the argument that this case, to a degree, brought to my mind hospitals throughout our state and throughout our community routinely hand to patients forms of power of attorney? Usually they are powers of attorney for medical decisions, but I think the same implications could occur. You're handing out forms to people for the patient to grant a power of attorney to make medical decisions for an individual's life. Does St. Mary's or Renown have a duty to, when they hand those forms to a patient's friend or neighbor or acquaintance?
I think they have a duty to do so non-negligently. Again, the duty is broad, and it depends on the foreseeability of harm.
Is that because of the special relationship that exists when the patient comes into the hospital and the hospital undertakes to provide those forms?
I certainly think so, and I certainly believe in this situation where Ms. Savage was in the custody, if you will, and her release was conditioned upon signing this form.
For me, the precedent of this case was in that area. I mean, you've got hospitals doing this, I think, routinely. So what duty do they undertake when they hand out those forms? And someone then is now the power of attorney, a durable power, has a durable power of attorney through the form provided by St. Mary's, and they decide to end your life.
Well, yes, similar
improperly
indeed.
Or negligently, yes. Arguably.
The problem that we have here is in this very facility 7 days earlier, they deemed this woman incompetent. So they had within the chart, they had knowledge, this is an elder care facility. This isn't a typical hospital patient relationship. They know they are dealing with people that have mental infirmities and that they have to deal carefully and specially with these people. And so to the extent that it's comparable to hospitals giving powers of attorney for medical care decisions, it's different because that person has made a apparently rational decision about how they would like to meet the end of their life. Here, this situation, she was not at the end of her life, but they facilitated the criminal activity that financially devastated Ms. Savage.
So providing the forms doesn't create the duty. It's what happens after you provide the form and in the context in which the forms provided.
Absolutely. And in the context that these forms were provided, it was a condition upon Ms. Savage's release that she signed those forms.
And it was done knowing that she was, per their own doctor, mentally incompetent.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Ms. Bradley.
Thank you.
Ms. Crawford?
Good afternoon, Justices. May it please the Court. I would like to clear up one simple issue. This power of attorney was not a condition of Ms. Savage's release. It's somewhat of a red herring. Ms. Six required this power of attorney within which to take her into care. The power of attorney was not required by Senior Bridges. Senior Bridges would have released Ms. Savage to Ms. Six's care regardless of whether this power of attorney was signed. Ms. Six is the one who required the signature on the power of attorney. In this case, plaintiff is somewhat...
Counsel, if I may, how do we know that without discovery?
In the pleadings, it states that Ms. Six wanted this power of attorney.
In the amended complaint,
correct.
It says that?
Correct. And in the general scope of hospitals, we release patients to friends and family members all of the time. And we don't require any sort of anything extra or special. We simply release them into their care. There's nothing extra that is required, and there's nothing extra that was required in this case.
So your memory is that the amended complaint recites that the condition of release was Ms. Six's, not the hospital's.
Right. The condition to take Ms. Savage into her care was Ms. Six's. This is not anything from Mr. Ling. This is not anything from the hospital. They simply would have released her to Ms. Six, or in the alternative, if Ms. Six hadn't have been there and she didn't have any other family or friends, as the facts are present in this case, they would have called in the state.
So if the amended complaint recited that as a condition of release, this power of attorney had to be signed by Ms. Six, then I assume your argument would be different.
I would agree, and I think that would add an additional fact and an additional element of within these two different scopes of duties, and I know we talked a little bit about special relationship and assumption of the duty. I think it would go to the weight of the gravity of those
things.
You
didn't argue special relationship to the district court, right?
I did not. I argued the general duty, and plaintiff somewhat deals with duty in the abstract, and I think in this case there are two ways that plaintiff can actually get to a duty requirement. In this case, we're talking about a financial duty. Plaintiff must show that Senior Bridges had a financial duty to Ms. Savage. This duty is not present as she is admitted to the hospital. Absent any other facts, I think plaintiff would actually agree with me that Senior Bridges does not owe Ms. Savage a financial duty. This duty must be created. In order to create this, plaintiff can go two different routes, either a special relationship or a voluntary assumption. I read these two things.
Why not with general negligence, though? I think your opponent's argument is there's a general duty of due care when you've undertaken to care for a woman your doctor has declared incompetent, and to facilitate the looting of her estate, you give somebody a power of attorney and suggest she sign it. Rather than calling the state, as you said would have happened if Ms. Six wouldn't have taken her, don't you undertake then at that point a duty of due care?
And I think that that duty of due care must be delineated into a duty of due care for her finances.
Why?
Because I think that we have to extend that duty to finances, as that is, those are in the facts of the case. She was financially ruined. In this, we do have a general duty of due care to keep her safe as a medical facility. We keep her safe medically. I don't think that the power of attorney gives rise to any other duties other than what we have already undertaken as a medical care facility.
But you undertook to give the power of attorney to Ms. Six and have Ms. Savage execute it. That was not a medical duty. What were you doing?
Correct. I think in looking at it in context, we're assisting the patient in future needs, but not necessarily in that document itself and the financial needs and the financial duty. I don't think that the financial duty is actually assumed by that. When we look at the two-prong test for special relationship and did this power of attorney actually create the special relationship, I think the controlling case is Cialba. In Cialba, you have to have control in order to create this duty. You have to have actual control. In our case, Northern Nevada or Senior Bridges did not have control over Ms. Savage's finances. They didn't have any ability to tell Ms. Savage, you have to pay this amount of money or you should go buy a Bentley. They don't have that power over her finances. It was not a condition of her discharge to sign this. We don't have any control. As counsel previously spoke, she may have been released. If it was medically appropriate, and that was your previous question, if it was medically appropriate to release her, they would have done so. They didn't require any power of attorney be signed, and therefore there's no control over Ms. Savage to make her sign this document. This is a document that is signed by two parties. And I know in the briefs, plaintiff's counsel also adds the additional element of the notary. To me, the notary is somewhat of a non-factor in this case. The notary is not saying that this document is correct. The notary is not saying that this document is legally binding. The notary is...
You're facilitating the transaction by providing a notary. I think that's their point with that.
Okay, and I'm just, in it, looking at it as to the degree of what that actually did, it is just saying that Ms. Six and Ms. Savage actually appeared before and it was signed. I don't think that simply handing a pre-printed power of attorney over to either Ms. Six or Ms. Savage, it's unclear from the complaint, I don't think that that simple act, including the notary, gives rise to a special relationship. However,
but what if you add in the fact that her medical chart shows that she's medically incompetent, and the assumption is if you're giving someone a power of attorney, they're going to execute it. Why is that not fit under your general negligence rubric, at least for getting past a 12b-5 motion?
Okay. I think that when we look at that, it's still a question of degree. Does that give rise to a duty? And my answer to that is no. But even if that creates that special relationship, the court has to look at whether the harm was foreseeable in this two-prong test. The foreseeability, and in plaintiff's brief, he tries to delineate between the duty for the special relationship test or the duty for proximate cause. I would submit that the court looked at this directly in Mangeris. Mangeris is the cab company case where the massage parlor knew that there was a violent criminal, knew that he was a fugitive from the law, and still didn't warn the cab driver. The court looked at foreseeability in that aspect of, was it foreseeable that this violent criminal, this known fugitive from the law, would actually kill the cab driver at some remote time and place? We're not looking at an opening of the door. We're not looking at, does this knowledge open the door that he may be violent? It has to be the actual act in the actual crime foreseeability.
Well, Mr. Crawford, I'd like to take Mangeris and pose the question in the context of Restatement Section 320. You would acknowledge that you have sufficient control of the patient, at least for purposes of deciding discharge, eh?
Agreed.
And under the Restatement Section, there is a duty of the private hospital having custody of the patient to consider the helplessness of the patient, the peculiar risk to which the patient is exposed, and the duty to anticipate danger. Now, this is not a Butler versus Bayer case where the prison simply took the defendant and dumped him on his girlfriend's mobile home and said, here, take care of this ailing defendant or inmate. But the question, the key question, is whether or not, as part of an assessment of dangers, this court should, in the case of people who are incompetent, consider whether there is a risk or a danger of financial exploitation. When the person to whom you are releasing the patient to insists upon a power of attorney, does that place your client on a heightened awareness of a financial risk?
And I think in addressing that question, we have to look at two different aspects. I'll answer the latter first. The power of attorney in and of itself, in this case, does not give rise to any foreseeability of a nefarious action by Ms. Six. The requesting of the power of attorney by Ms. Six is simply because she wants to take care of her friend without coming out of her pocket any. Ms. Savage is an elderly patient. She is likely going to require a significant amount of money to effectuate that process. The general asking of a power of attorney by Ms. Six is not nefarious and does not give rise, especially to the foreseeability in this case. Additionally, I think that if we start requiring hospitals to start looking at all of the delinquencies of the world that may encumber a patient or a former patient, we put upon them many duties, and in this case, a financial duty. In order for the hospital to make sure that a patient is financially successful or can thrive outside the walls, what does that require of the hospital? Does that require a full-time financial analyst? Does that require the hospital to go check on a patient every 2 weeks after? Does that require the hospital have control over a patient's funds? I would say that extends the duties of a hospital way beyond the realm of a medical care facility and instead makes them a keeper of all safe patients for however long indefinitely.
But in this case, there's the allegation that the doctor had deemed her demented and incapable of managing her own affairs, correct?
That's correct.
Which presumptively is attached to Ling, correct?
Correct.
So with that knowledge, that narrows the duty and the parade of horribles pretty considerably to patients who are demented, whose friends are demanding powers of attorney before they take transfer of custody. It seems to me to be a lot narrower than you're saying.
Right, and I understand your point, and I think that if we narrow it down into that example, what we end up doing is we make the hospital responsible for who the patient goes into the care of. If in this case Ms. Six was a family member, would the hospital then be required to make sure that this family member has financial planning, that this family member is able to care for the patient financially? Do they have the wherewithal? And one example that comes to my mind is a concussion patient. We discharge patients with concussions all the time and tell whoever's picking them up, please don't let them fall asleep within the next 12 hours. But let's say, hypothetically, the friend is a narcoleptic and falls asleep, and then the concussed patient ends up with a deleterious outcome. I think that's what we're dealing with in this sort of genre. Are we required to do a background check, and what kind of information do we need to know from the person actually picking up and taking care of the patient? And in this case, I don't think it matters if it's Ms. Six or a family member. If financial ruin becomes of Ms. Savage due to this family member, either through nefarious acts or just simple negligence by that family member, are we required and are we going to be liable for that negligent or nefarious act of the person
but
taking
I think
care.
To take your hypothetical, we would have to be discharging, we would have to be giving the person who's taking the concussed patient sleeping pills, say, because they're so distraught over this. If we did that, then would there be a duty? I think that's the difference in this case, is that we interfered with that relationship that we were discharging this person into. Whereas in your concussed patient, unless we you know, doped up the caretaker somehow to ease their feelings. I mean, right. I think that's the point, that there was more than just negligence in the air.
Right. And I understand your point, and I think that that just goes back to the degree. The power of attorney in and of itself is not the kryptonite. It's the signatures on it and the nefarious acts of Ms. Six. I think a simple act is, in this case, that's not the kryptonite. Ling handing over this power of attorney is not the same as the sleeping pills. Within the sleeping pills, we know exactly what's going to happen to the person picking the patient up. They're going to fall asleep. In this case, when we give the power of attorney over to Ms. Sat or to Ms. Six, we don't know what's going to happen, and I don't think that we have foreseeability that that's going to happen.
So what you're suggesting is that in order for the duty to be present with respect to financial exploitation being one of the risks or dangers that the hospital should consider under the restatement before a release occurs, is that it should have some information about Ms. Six actually undertaking this kind of activity.
I think that that is the responsibility that a ruling that this did create a duty would levy upon hospitals. And I would say that that would create a broad range of duties, not just financially, for patients outside the walls of the hospital. And that's a concern with public policy that I have.
Thank you very much. Ms. Bradley, I'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal.
I think the point here that has to be clearly made is that Senior Bridges is a facility that is dedicated and devoted to the care of the elderly. And they, in taking inferences in a light most favorable to the plaintiff, one must infer that Senior Bridges is keenly aware of the tremendous vulnerability of incompetent elderly people, and that when Ms. Six or anybody else, if it were the Pope who was accepting the discharge of Ms. Savage, requested that the condition upon discharge be that a general power of attorney is signed in favor of that individual, would be a huge red flag to anybody involved in elder care to be on the lookout or be deeply concerned about the financial wherewithal of the person that they are discharging. Again, this is not a typical hospital. It's not where I go in for a cut at emergency.
Well, the choice is really rather simple. They could have just given her a power of attorney for her person, not her estate.
Well, the choice is we're not going to do this. We're simply not going to do this. We're going to take other actions.
Rather than a general power of attorney, you can give a power of attorney for their person rather than their estate, and then that power isn't sufficient to effectuate financial.
Or you can give a special power of attorney.
Sure.
There's many alternatives, but the massive legal import of a general power of attorney is much too great to have clinical social workers at elder care facilities willy-nilly handing them out to anybody. Thank you,
Mr. Bradley. Thank you, Mr. Crawford, for your argument. Also, the panel appreciates your professionalism, both of you. This matter will stand submitted.